From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, Roberto De Bernardi and Paula Claycomb, two members of the staff of Sudan's UNICEF office, are joining us to discuss the crisis in the Darfur region of Western Sudan. In that desolate region of northern Africa, over 1 million individuals have been forced from their homes, and their flight to refugee camps has precipitated the greatest refugee crisis of the decade. We'll discuss the public health consequences of this conflict and UNICEF's response to the crisis. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our first news item today comes from the Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs. On July 7th, a hearing held before that committee found that about 15,000 children with mental illnesses were improperly incarcerated in detention centers in 2003 because of a lack of access to treatment. The report found that 33 states detain children with mental illnesses who face no criminal charges. Over a quarter of these juvenile detention centers incarcerated children with mental illnesses who were less than 11 years old. Some of the witnesses who testified said that children with mental illnesses often are incarcerated because their parents do not have access to treatment in schools and they lack health coverage for mental health care. Commenting on the findings of the Senate hearing, Dr. Ken Martinez of the New Mexico Department of Children, Youth, and Families said that the report highlights the fact that juvenile detention centers have become de facto psychiatric hospitals for mentally ill youth. The report can be found at the website of the U.S. Senate, senate.gov. During the week of July 12th, the 15th International AIDS Conference is taking place in Bangkok, Thailand. In advance of the conference, UNAIDS, the United Nations agency that coordinates global AIDS-related activities, released a report which describes daunting trends in the trajectory of the epidemic and an increasing need for assistance in the world's fight against the pandemic. According to the report, 5 million new HIV cases were reported worldwide last year, the most cases reported in any single year since the beginning of the epidemic. The report shows that the number of people living with HIV increased from 35 million in 2001 to 38 million in 2003. Also, nearly 3 million people died from AIDS-related causes last year. And about 50% of new HIV cases worldwide were among people aged 15 to 24. Also, about half of the new cases were female. Although sub-Saharan Africa remains the most affected region in the world with about 25 million infected people, the report indicates that Asia could face an AIDS catastrophe if the region does not make bigger strides in combating the disease. Asia, which accounts for 60% of the world's population, has over 7 million HIV-infected people and has experienced some of the sharpest increases in the number of cases. Though that epidemic in Asia is still concentrated among drug users, men who have sex with men, and commercial sex workers and their clients, the Asian epidemic is fast moving into the general population. And China, Indonesia, and Vietnam, which together account for half the population of Asia, are seeing rapidly expanding epidemics. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization provided a discouraging report on its initiative to have 3 million people infected with HIV in poor countries under treatment by the end of 2005. Approximately 440,000 people are currently being treated. That's about twice as many as in 2002, but this would still mean that WHO has only reached 15% of the number of HIV-infected people it would like to have under treatment by the end of next year. The Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Lee Jong-wook, said that the agency could not fail in this effort because the collective response to the HIV epidemic is the benchmark by which our generation will be judged. The agency attributed slow progress to a lack of money, with conspicuously meager contributions from the United States. But the finances have improved recently when it received larger than anticipated contributions from Canada, Britain, and Sweden. About 1,000 protesters held a rally as the conference was about to convene to call for increased access to antiretroviral drugs. The demonstrators presented a letter to the Thai government and to the World Health Organization demanding that the Thai government ensure antiretroviral drug coverage and avoid signing free trade agreements that would prevent inexpensive generic HIV drugs from becoming available in Thailand. Another group of protesters picketed the pharmaceutical company GlaxoSmithKline's exhibition booth at the conference. In June, Glaxo announced it has issued a voluntary license to a South African drug company to produce generic versions of two of Glaxo's antiretroviral drugs. But protesters pointed out that not one generic AIDS drug has been produced in South Africa, and thus far Glaxo has not granted a generic license in any other country. In other words, the company has done essentially nothing to ensure that inexpensive HIV drugs become available in these desperately poor countries with major HIV epidemics. On July 6th, Great Britain announced a significant increase in funding for the HIV and women's reproductive health initiatives in developing countries which are coordinated by United Nations agencies. About $66 million will go to UNAIDS over the next 4 years and approximately $148 million for the UN Population Fund. This represents more than 20% increase in the country's contribution to the Population Fund. According to Hillary Benn, Secretary of Staff for the country's Department for International Development, sexual and reproductive health are inextricably linked to AIDS. By taking action on one, we know we are also helping to tackle the other. She added that the UN Population Fund's work is absolutely critical to efforts to prevent the spread of HIV. Shortly after taking office in the United States, the Bush administration cut off all U.S. support for the UN Population Fund, despite widespread criticism from women's rights groups and from public health groups. The aid cutoff continues to this day, and the Bush administration has stated that it does not intend to reverse its policy. Coming up next, the public health crisis in the Darfur region of Sudan. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The events which have occurred over the last several months in the Darfur region of Sudan now constitute the greatest refugee crisis of the decade. Paramilitary gangs there have driven out much of the native population and destroyed one village after the next. Current estimates place the number of refugees at over 1 million. The central government of Sudan has taken virtually no steps to defend the native population and is widely felt to be supporting the paramilitary squads. Many of the refugees have fled their homes with such minimal notice after their villages are invaded that they haven't had time to gather possessions. The refugees have been gathering in larger cities closer to the border of Chad, the neighboring country to the west, and many have crossed the border into Chad, seeking a safer haven, even though it may be more difficult for them to return home. But refugee crises never involve only homelessness. There are invariably major impacts on the health of refugee populations. Malnutrition, war-related injuries, and infectious diseases, aggravated by lack of sanitation and the crowded conditions in the refugee camps, convert the refugee crisis into a public health crisis. Joining us today to discuss the crisis in Western Sudan and its impacts on the health of the people who live there are Roberto De Bernardi and Paula Claycomb. Roberto De Bernardi is a medical doctor raised in Genoa, Italy, who has spent virtually his entire career doing humanitarian work. He joined the staff of UNICEF in 1988 and has served as a health and nutrition officer at several different sites throughout Africa since then. Currently, he is UNICEF's senior project officer and chief of health and nutrition at UNICEF's office in Khartoum, the capital city of Sudan. Paula Claycomb is UNICEF's communication officer at the Khartoum office of UNICEF. She has worked for UNICEF for 15 years, and prior to that worked for Amnesty International. She has devoted her career to the protection and development of vulnerable children in some of the world's poorest countries. Both she and Roberto De Bernardi have made numerous visits to various parts of Darfur over the last year. Listeners should be aware of the fact that UNICEF is dependent on cooperation with the Sudanese government to complete its humanitarian mission, and therefore listeners will not be hearing significant criticism of the government of Sudan during this interview. Listeners who wish to learn more about the role of the government of Sudan in this conflict are directed to the website of Human Rights Watch, which is hrw.org. Today's interview was recorded on July 13th. The two guests were obliged to share a phone line in Sudan's UNICEF office, and I apologize in advance for the less than ideal phone connection. Paula Claycomb and Roberto De Bernardi, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Before we discuss the current crisis in the Darfur region of Sudan, I'm wondering if you could provide some history and background about Darfur. Who lives there and how do they get by? And I guess one of the reasons I'm asking this question is because with some of the photographs I've seen of the area, it actually looks very desolate. Isn't it part of the Sahara Desert?
Well, yes, it is part of the desert. It's a huge area. It's a region about the size of France. It's composed of three states, most of which is pretty dry terrain, and it is, however, home to about 6 million people. So despite the harsh territory, people have managed to survive there for centuries, and the roots of this conflict actually go back many, many, many years, although I think that it's fair to say that most recently, at the beginning of 2003, a couple of groups came together and began to call attention of the Khartoum government to the underdeveloped aspects of the region. They demanded more resources to be put in, and they did that, unfortunately, in a violent way, which led to a harsh response by the government, with the result that 1 million of the residents of Darfur have been forced from their homes and are now in displaced persons, either camps or other locations.
One of the things that's been finally reaching the news reports here in the U.S. are the fact that it appears that one village after the next are being, I guess the best word might be pillaged, that they're being raided, and food stores and markets are being destroyed, and people are being brutalized significantly. And I was wondering if that captures what you're seeing.
That is, in fact, an accurate description. Most of the displacement took place, say, from June or July onwards in 2003 and in the first 3 months of 2004. So what we're seeing now are continued movements of displaced people, although they seem to be going from one place to another in search of better security, because unfortunately the conflict continues. And you are right in saying that the villages were burned and pillaged. So literally the people ran for their lives with only the clothes that they had and unable in most cases to take any food with them. So that is one reason why now they, in the camps where they have gathered, are facing severe food shortages and, of course, all of the health problems that go along with living in pretty much open spaces with poor sanitation and practically no health facilities and other facilities available.
I guess just focusing just for another minute on the conflict itself, most of the descriptions that have made it through to the Western media, or at least the media here in the U.S., have been give very little understanding of what's behind it, in the sense of if one group is driving another group of people out of their villages, and it sounded like lighter skinned people are driving darker skinned people out of their villages, is there some sort of benefit that's going to accrue to those people? Are they planning on settling there? Is that clear from what's gone on?
No, it's not at all clear. The whole situation is pretty murky. And for those people who are outside Sudan looking in at it, it looks like it's pretty much a cut-and-dried ethnic-based conflict. For those of us who are inside, there are clearly ethnic overtones to it. But it's also true that many people are being displaced who one would think would not have been forced from their homes by these armed militias. And, of course, UNICEF's position is that children in need anywhere deserve to have their rights to health and education and shelter met. So UNICEF is working with the displaced population no matter where they are and no matter what ethnic group they come from. And it's such a complex situation that it's difficult to get a handle on it, even for people who are familiar with the Sudan, which has a long and colorful and complex history. The 1 million people who have been displaced are spread over this large region in over 130 different locations, ranging maybe from 2,000 or 3,000 in one place to over 60,000 in another place, which means that the delivery of services becomes that much more difficult, trying to reach them in a region that already is underdeveloped with very few roads and practically no paved roads and only 3 airports serving the entire region.
And what's been the role of the government of Sudan? Have they been part of the problem in terms of part of the invading force of these, supporting these paramilitary or militias, whatever you want to call them?
Well, the Secretary General put it pretty well when he was here a couple weeks ago. He said the solution has to be a political solution. The warring parties have to get together and work out a solution that is going to be sustainable. The humanitarian response, of course, is focused on getting the supplies and the services into the people who need it most. Now, UNICEF is in the both fortunate and perhaps somewhat peculiar position of working with government over the course of the past 30 years in providing services to its people, largely in the health, education, and water sectors. And it's no different in the Darfur region, where our partners include the state ministries of health and water and the National Water Corporation. So on the one hand, while the federal or the Khartoum-based government has to look for a solution at the political level, at the local level, we're working closely with those ministries.
Unfortunately, we've seen many refugee crises over the last 20 to 30 years. And when you're looking at this refugee crisis, how do you see it as being different from some of the others that have occurred, for example, in the Balkans or in Central Africa?
Uh-huh. Oh, I guess it's hard to put tags on different crises, because human suffering is human suffering no matter where it is. I suppose one aspect that makes this one different is the sheer size of it. We're talking about 1 million people who have been forced from their homes and who are spread out across an immense and extremely difficult region. So compared to the Balkans, where it was possibly a smaller region that had its own set of complexities, this one is characterized by the sheer size of the displaced population and the difficult terrain, and then, of course, the already underdeveloped services that existed before this crisis began last year.
Now, it's easy for people to see the Darfur situation as a major violation of human rights, but as you've already mentioned, the problem that starts out as a human rights crisis or a war ends up being a crisis of public health, and that's of course why you're there. So I'd like to ask you to discuss some of the major impacts that this refugee crisis has on the health of the residents of Darfur, and how you respond to those, including, you know, especially UNICEF, but other aid organizations. Maybe we could start out with the issue of water. How does water become available?
Sudan has plenty of water, although much of it is underground. So it's largely a question of drilling for it and bringing it to the surface so that it is accessible to the people. And UNICEF has been the coordinating agency in the water and sanitation sector and is now providing safe water to some 445,000 displaced persons. So almost half the population now have a point of safe water. But along with the provision of safe water has to come good sanitation facilities. And there again, UNICEF and its other partners, in conjunction with the National Water Corporation, has dug latrines for community use so that the whole issue of open defecation can be minimized. But I think maybe now that you're getting into some of the health issues, I can pass the phone to Roberto, who is the health officer for UNICEF, and he can talk more about the health situation of the people in general and the children in particular. Okay, so I'll pass to him, and then you can follow up on this question.
Very good.
And pose it to him. Thank you.
Thanks, Paula.
Hello.
Roberto Di Bernardi, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Hi, good morning. It's a pleasure.
Roberto, in the discussion with Paula, we just discussed the issue of availability of drinking water and then sanitation. And if you heard her answer, if you'd like to add anything to her answer, you can do that before we move on to the issue of malnutrition and food.
Sure. It is a bit difficult to quantify the exact situation in terms of, gap for drinking water and for sanitation. What I can say is that the gap is huge, especially as far as sanitation is concerned. We are talking about probably something like three-quarters of the war-affected people, the 1.2 million that Paula was mentioning before, who may not have access right now to latrines, probably. There are plans underway really going to scale as far as latrine construction is concerned, but we are still quite far from having achieved a good result in terms of sanitation. And of course, this is a key period for going to scale with latrine construction and utilization, of course, because the rain season has just started. The crowding that we are having in some camps, the risk of cholera is there, and I can let you imagine what kind of disaster we may have if there are cholera outbreaks in these camps.
Now, cholera outbreak would mean profound, severe diarrhea, and I guess the implication is that's contracted via water, implying that the water itself is unsafe. So has that been occurring, and how do you address that if it occurs?
Well, let's say that I would agree with you, of course, but only partially, because without wanting to be cynical, of course, let's not forget that these poor people, unfortunately, even before the crisis, had to drink water which was not bacteriologically pure, at least according to our standards. So the main problem is really the crowding and the lack of sanitation. Of course, before they could afford, in quotes, to drink water which was not of the best possible quality, because there was no crowding, because some of them, at least, they had their own latrines, and even if they didn't have any latrine, because of the larger space that they had available, again, the risk of transmission of cholera and of any other waterborne disease was relatively limited. Now, with this situation of crowding and of lack of adequate sanitation, of course, the risk increases a lot. Then there is another factor that one has to be taken into consideration. As Paula said, that there is quite a lot underground water in Sudan, and that water is basically pure. It's basically good for human consumption, even according to our standards, probably. But the main problem is that often that pure water, pure from the source, is not stored in clean containers. It is not, I would say, adequately handled. And that is why it is not just a matter of making sure that those people can have access to clean and safe water, but the issue is also making sure that those people maintain this water clean and safe.
What about the issue of food? You're talking about 1.2 million people that are now that don't have a source of food, basically, and I was wondering, how do you get food to a large numbers of people that are moving, that aren't even stable, I mean, one location?
Yes. As Paula said, some of them, when they had to leave their homes, could not manage to take anything with them. Some others managed to leave with some food reserves, with some animals as well. Now, some of these 1.2 million are people who live in houses occupied, let's say, by relatives, by friends, by people belonging to the same ethnic groups, etc., etc. So they manage, let's say, to share the same food basket that these normal residents have. Of course, food which was before sufficient for, let's say, 10 people, now has to be enough for 15 or 20 or even more. Same time, WFP, of course, has launched a massive operation to provide food aid to a lot of these people. I think they are now reaching more or less 65-70% of these people with monthly rations.
In your observations on the ground in Darfur, what percentage of the children and of the adults suffer from malnutrition?
Well, the situation is very poor, of course. Same time, again, without wanting to be cynical, one should not forget where those poor people, unfortunately, started from. I mean, we are talking about 2-3 years ago, in a peaceful environment, as it was the greater Darfur 2-3 years ago. We are talking about global acute malnutrition rates as high as 20-22%. Without any particular aggravating factor like any outbreak you can think about or drought. So under normal circumstances, the region was already plagued with very high global acute malnutrition rates. Now, of course, we are talking about food security, which is greatly at risk. We are talking about measles cases from time to time, although this measles campaign, which has just been conducted and I would say successfully completed, should somehow, if not completely stop the transmission, considerably decrease in morbidity and mortality due to measles. So we are talking about an environment where one should not be unfortunately too surprised if global acute malnutrition rates are very high. In some camps, like for instance Abu Shouk camp in North Darfur, it is a camp which is inhabited by some 35,000 people more or less. A survey which was conducted some 2 or 3 weeks ago show the global acute malnutrition rate as high as 39%. So this means that basically 4 out of 10 under 5 children were moderately, if not severely, malnourished, and therefore in need of special food aid in addition to the normal WFP general food ration.
Children who are malnourished would undoubtedly be a setup for infection, and if they were to become infected, they would likely handle it more poorly than would otherwise be the case. And so I was wondering if we could talk about some of the other types of infectious diseases. You already mentioned measles. Some of these children undoubtedly have other respiratory illnesses. They may be subject to tuberculosis or malaria and other intestinal infections. And I was wondering if you could discuss some of these other infectious illnesses and what the findings are in those areas.
Sure. Well, as you already know, of course, malnutrition and diseases is a sort of vicious circle. A malnourished child is much more prone to get infected with basically any disease, including measles that you have mentioned, tuberculosis, diarrheal diseases, acute respiratory infection, etc., etc. On the other hand, a previously healthy child who gets measles has many more chances to become malnourished because, of course, sick, he's coughing, he doesn't eat well, he has diarrhea, perhaps the mother decides to stop breastfeeding him because of some traditional beliefs, etc., etc. And so, again, it is a sort of vicious circle. Then when he recovers from measles, he's malnourished, and therefore he's again, as I was saying, more prone to become sick. You have mentioned measles. When I spoke about that camp with the 39 global acute malnutrition rate, apparently there is quite a clear evidence that such a high rate was also caused not just by lack of food, not just by poor feeding practices, etc., but also by a lot of measles cases that did take place in the camp in the weeks before the survey. And apparently some of those children who fell under the category of malnourished children had suffered of measles. Of course, we do not have right now any clear data, not yet, at least on the case fatality rate of that small measles outbreak in that camp, but for sure it was quite high. Now, if we talk still about measles, about the whole country, the whole Sudan, the Minister of Health estimates that every year there are between 200,000 and 300,000 cases of measles, every year, regularly, in spite of a relatively high coverage rate, which is at around 70%. It is good, of course, but not good, at least for sub-Saharan Africa standards, but not good enough to interrupt circulation of the virus. In addition to measles, you have already mentioned acute respiratory infections. These, of course, are a very common disease in Sudan, especially during the dry, relatively cool season. We are talking about people who do not have adequate shelter, and I can assure you that in that area, in spite of having during daytime temperatures which are around 40 degrees Celsius, which is around, I think it's above 100 degrees Fahrenheit, during nighttime, it can be relatively cool. If you don't have bed sheets and blanket and adequate shelter, you can really be at risk of getting pneumonia or bronchitis or any other acute respiratory infections. You had mentioned cholera. Clearly, it is a great risk, not necessarily for small children, but for the entire population. And I'm sure that you remember what happened in Goma with tens of thousands of cases of cholera and several thousand deaths. I'm talking about Eastern Zaire, in that camp where close to 1 million Rwandan refugees settled in 1994 when the FDR took over Rwanda. I would like to add at least one more disease, which is malaria. As Paula said, this is a very dry area, it is true, but right now the rainy season is starting. Malaria transmission is basically seasonal transmission, but it can be deadly as well as in any other region of Sudan where malaria can be endemic during the whole year. As far as malaria is concerned, it may be also important to know that right now, literally a few days ago, the Minister of Health has decided to change the first-line treatment, the guidelines for the first-line treatment of malaria. So we have moved from chloroquine as a first-line drug to artemisinin combination therapy as first line, meaning artesunate plus sulfadoxin perimethamine. Now, the only problem is that the stocks of artesunate available in the country are very, very, very limited, to say the least. And of course, one should not forget that the cost of this new malaria course is going to be around 10 times higher than what the cost of the old malaria course used to be. Of course, it's going to be also much more effective. But it will be necessary to find the funds to sustain, let's say, this new malaria protocol.
This sounds like it would be a huge problem if the funds that UNICEF has available are limited. I know that chloroquine, which you pointed out, is a much cheaper treatment, but my understanding was that it's simply not effective anymore in most of Africa. And therefore, it would seem that the recommendation to switch to the more expensive drug is pretty reasonable. But where do you get the funds and purchase the new combination drug? And is the drug actually available? Can you get it if you do have the money?
Yes, I absolutely agree with you. Chloroquine probably has made its time in most of the African countries, including Sudan, and that is why the government of Sudan has taken the decision in accordance, let's say, with UNICEF and WHO overall policy. At the same time, I mean, the problem is still there, and one should not, hide behind the fact that chloroquine is ineffective, because it is true, it is ineffective, but let me be, I would say, the devil's advocate. Having said, of course, that UNICEF and myself as well, we are fully supportive of the new treatment guidelines. One may wonder whether it is better to have a drug which is effective maybe in just 50% of the cases, but available to almost 100% of the people, or is it better to have a drug which is effective in maybe 95 or even 100% of the cases, but can be made available to only 10% of the people, exactly because of financial reasons. We should aim at having this drug, expensive drug, available to as many people as possible, preferably 100% of the people in the shortest possible time. Now, having said this, this start to order artesunate even before the protocol was officially approved by the Minister of Health, because it seemed clear that that was the trend, and we are already distributing and using artesunate in at least some of the facilities in the Darfur area. We have much more artesunate in the pipeline, and we are also anxiously, I would say, waiting for funds which were promised by the United States, actually, and that should allow us to buy probably enough artesunate for all that 1.2 million population in Darfur for all the malaria cases between now and the end of the year.
Well, let's take a short break. We've been speaking with Paula Claycombe and Roberto De Bernardi from UNICEF Sudan about the humanitarian crisis in the Darfur region of Western Sudan and how UNICEF and other aid organizations are responding. After the break, we'll continue the discussion, including a look at how UNICEF responds to the impacts on children's mental health of witnessing violence and being forced to abruptly leave their homes and communities. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guests today are Paula Claycombe and Roberto De Bernardi, both staff members of the UNICEF office in Sudan. For those who are unfamiliar with the conflict in Western Sudan, paramilitary militias, with the tacit support of Sudan's government, have killed thousands of residents, driven out much of the native population, and destroyed their villages. Current estimates place the number of refugees at approximately 1 million. And as is always the case with both military conflict and refugee crises, the issue is not merely one of housing refugees. There is a tremendous impact on the health of the fleeing population, especially the children. And that's the topic we're addressing in today's interview. Since the interview is being recorded directly from the UNICEF's office in Khartoum, only a single phone line was available, which our two guests had to share. Now back to the interview. You mentioned some of the diseases that we're discussing can be prevented with variable effectiveness by vaccination. And one of the diseases we've already discussed is measles. I know there are several others. The disease is preventable through vaccination that may be important in that area. And I guess I'm wondering, how do you administer vaccine in insecure situations of conflict?
Yeah, well, you have mentioned measles vaccination. I would say that this is probably the single most important public health intervention for children, at least in a situation like the one we are having in Darfur right now, with a lot of camps, crowding, displaced people. Fortunately, there was a ceasefire. Well, the ceasefire was not really fully respected by both parties, but anyway, it was not really fully respected. But in spite of this, during the month of May and June, there was, I would say, a considerable decrease in the severity of the conflict. And this allowed us to vaccinate around close to 2.1 million children aged from 9 months to 15 years in the greater Darfur. And this is quite close to the threshold of 95%, which is considered to be a sort of sufficient threshold for basically stopping measles transmission. Unfortunately, the reason why we couldn't reach this 95% threshold, you mentioned conflict areas, how are you going to vaccinate in conflict areas? Sometimes it is possible to negotiate access to areas which are, let's say, controlled by rebel groups or by, let's say, the other side. Other times it is unfortunately not possible. So we have been successful in the north and in the south of Darfur, where the coverage rates are well above 95%. We have not been fully successful in western Darfur, where probably around 300,000 children, let's say between 200 and 300,000 children, could not be reached and therefore could not be vaccinated. Now, perhaps there has been, I would say, a blessing in disguise, meaning, again, without wanting to be too cynical, but after so many years in Africa, one unfortunately starts to become a bit cynical. There has been, I'm sure you have heard about it, a polio case isolated in West Darfur. She's a girl, she's 4 or 5 years old, more or less, and she got polio around the end of May. We got the confirmation from the CDC Atlanta a few weeks ago. It is unfortunately a wild poliovirus. It is a wild poliovirus which is 99% similar to the wild poliovirus which came from Kano, Nigeria, those states where unfortunately polio immunization activities were brought to a halt because of some concerns about vaccine safety and some cultural issues. So the virus basically traveled through northern Nigeria, from Kano to the border of northern Nigeria, passed through Chad, and there have been some, I think, 23 cases in Chad during the year 2003, and managed to, unfortunately, to reach the border with Sudan, Chad, Sudan, crossed the border, and infected this poor girl who developed polio, and unfortunately, she's now having some sequelae of polio. Now, as a result, the technical advisory group has decided to launch some polio mopping up activities covering the whole of Darfur, in July, meaning the end of July, this month of July, and the end of August. So this is going to provide, I would say, a formidable opportunity for us and we have already started, we've already completed the negotiation with the Minister of Health and with WHO to make sure that in addition to polio, also measles vaccine is going to be offered to those children living in those areas that were not covered. Of course, this is going to be subject to a successful negotiation of access to those areas, because also polio vaccinators are going to be faced exactly with the same problem. I mean, there are other people in control of that particular region, in control of those populations. I mean, one has to, again, negotiate access. If I may make reference to my past experience in Africa, having worked in other countries, it is not always successful. I'm thinking about Angola, for instance, the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, most of the UNITA-controlled areas could not be accessed by anybody with the exception of ICRC and some few NGOs who were not, let's say, passing through Luanda, the capital of Angola, the government of Angola, but they were going to the UNITA-controlled areas coming from other African countries. In Somalia, if I can think about my most recent experience, negotiating access was even more difficult because we had to deal with literally tens and tens and tens of different warlords and clan factions and parties. Now, in the case of Darfur, it seems as if, although there may not be a clear front line, I would say, to cross, it seems as if there are basically two parties, the government and SLA as people, and therefore the negotiation may be, I would say, relatively easy, of course, relatively speaking. The ICRC has also been, for the time being, just informally contacted, and they are examining the possibility of helping us, ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and they are, I hope, at least examining the possibility of helping us in this negotiating access exercise.
Now, one of the other medical issues you may face are injuries basically related to the conflict itself. Does UNICEF and other aid organizations you work with, do they have the ability to actually treat people who are injured from whatever, gunshot wounds or other types of trauma?
Well, first of all, let me give you some ideas of the magnitude of the problem that you have just mentioned. There has been a nutritional survey conducted by MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, in two camps in Western Darfur, two of the biggest camps in Western Darfur, perhaps the biggest camps in Western Darfur. They found out that between half and three quarters of the deaths in the, I think, 2 months preceding the survey could be directly attributable to war, to conflict. And close to half of the child deaths could also be directly attributable to war and conflict. So we are talking about a huge number of people who have unfortunately directly suffered because of this war, because of this conflict, which is not just a war and conflict of armies, it's also unfortunately a war and conflict of civilians who are caught between the two armies. Now, UNICEF per se is not working directly with war wounded. This is really the International Committee of the Red Cross work, also because of some political sensitivities. And even the International Committee of the Red Cross workers sometimes are at great risk. I personally knew some of the people who were murdered in Burundi, I think it was 1995 or 1996 when I was there. And they had been accused of giving priority to either wounded rebels or wounded government soldiers, and they were killed. And I mean, this is a very, very sensitive area. We do not have, I would say, either the political mandate or the technical skills for really dealing effectively with war wounded.
Another issue that undoubtedly comes up, which you previously mentioned, when you're dealing with new refugees that you haven't seen before, are the fact that their previous health may not have been very good. And I just wonder how much planning and resource allocation you have to do to deal with old medical problems. For example, infestations with parasites or tuberculosis or HIV. And I'm wondering if these older diseases are also something you need to confront in your aid effort.
Yeah, of course, the heritage, I would say, of the past in terms of poor health is definitely there. I mean, we are talking about, as I was saying before, if we take a global acute malnutrition rate as a sort of proxy indicator of the health status, at least of the children of the greater Darfur, we are talking about a very, very poor status, even in a pre-war situation. Of course, if you add food security, which is now at stake, if you add the war-related injuries, if you add the health hazard related to the crowding, poor sanitation, the picture that comes out of all this is not really rosy. Now, in terms of investment and response to this, at the beginning of this year, we had a so-called country program, UNICEF Sudan country program. Now, the UNICEF Sudan country program has almost become, a UNICEF Darfur country program because most of the resources, human and financial, had to be devoted to this Darfur crisis. And this, I would say, on one hand, of course, is fully comprehensible because, again, the size of the problem, suffering of these people, et cetera, et cetera. But on the other hand, we should not forget that Sudan is a poor country, not just in the Darfur area, in the Darfur region. And there are still hundreds of thousands of IDPs in the rest of Sudan, and nobody now is talking about them. I'm thinking about, for instance, the people who were affected by the floods in Kassala around 1 year ago. I'm thinking about people who came from the south because of the war. And I'm thinking about other people who have been affected by ethnic conflicts in the Red Sea state, not far from the Red Sea, of course. And therefore, I mean, it's the whole of Sudan which is really in need of help, in need of support, not just the greater Darfur. But of course, right now, correctly, the attention of the international community focusing on Darfur, and I mean, as I said before, UNICEF is really to reshape considerably, if not totally, its country program to be able to effectively respond to this crisis.
Maybe for a moment we could turn to mental health impacts of the crisis in Sudan. And it must be incredibly traumatizing to children to suddenly have to leave the homes they've known their entire life and to leave their communities and to leave their friends and everyone in their neighborhood and suddenly be rushed out of the area. And I only can imagine what they've observed in terms of brutality and people injured and shot and brutalized or sexually assaulted. And God only knows what these children have seen. And I guess I'd like you to discuss what kinds of mental health issues you've seen among these children and how UNICEF responds to that.
You have correctly pointed out that a lot of these children have been exposed to scenes of, you have just mentioned, the murders. Let me also add that probably rapes. It seems as if something a bit similar to what I think also happened in the Balkans, that kind of, I would say, ethnic-based rapes. I cannot tell you anything about the scale of the problem, but for sure there have been cases of ethnic-based rapes. I'm sure you understand what I'm talking about, in front of children, clearly. Now, UNICEF is the leading agency in the child protection sector, which is taking care also of the psychosocial rehabilitation of these children. We are not really aiming at specialists like psychiatrists, etc., at least at this stage. We are rather aiming at the reinsertion of children in schools, in the families themselves, through a series of activities led by animators and teachers and the social workers in general. So I would say it's really a kind of a public health approach that we are giving to this problem. At the same time, sooner or later, it will be necessary, and I'm sure UNICEF will take the lead in probably organizing a study on this, it will be necessary to somehow quantify, although Paula said correctly before that it is very difficult to quantify the suffering. I think this is something actually that has already been said by I think, a politician, I don't remember now the name of the politician, during the Second World War when he was asked something about the killing of the Jews or something about massive killings and massive bombings. And he said that there is no number which can really express the suffering of people. It is useless to say whether 100,000 or 200,000 people have been killed, exactly because the suffering has been so great that no number can really quantify it. I mean, having said this, I think it is going to be necessary to probably conduct a sort of situation analysis as far as child traumas are concerned, and try to a certain extent to quantify how many children may really be in need of psychosocial support. Of course, this is an activity that probably can be planned and implemented once the conditions in the field are a bit more conducive to this kind of activity. For the time being, although, as I said before, and I can confirm it, security is probably a little bit better than what it used to be. For instance, in February and March, we are still quite far from having a stable situation which can be conducive to this kind of interventions.
What happens to orphans, to children who've lost their parents and are now orphans?
Fortunately, in Sudan, many of the families, the extended family system is part of the culture, so that usually when parents die here, the children are not left homeless. They're absorbed into the extended family. And thankfully, in the Darfur situation, so far we haven't seen a huge number of true orphans where both parents have died. We know of several instances where the father has been killed, in fewer instances where their mother has been killed, which of course is a difficult enough situation as it is. But thankfully, the instances of true orphans are so far relatively small, And in those cases, the children have been taken in by other relatives.
Now, on June 30th, Kofi Annan and Colin Powell visited Sudan, presumably to put pressure on the government, and said that they expected results within a week. So now 2 weeks have gone by. Have you seen any improvement in the situation?
Well, in fact, we've seen some improvement in the ability of the humanitarian agencies to carry out their duties, to carry out their mandates, in that travel permits are being facilitated, visas are being facilitated, the clearance of some of the goods and supplies that come into the country has been a little bit faster. So from a purely logistical standpoint, I would say, yes, there has been some improvement. However, unfortunately, people are still on the move, which means that they still don't feel secure enough to return to their homes, nor even stay in some of the locations where they had first gone to. And unfortunately, the situation is still so large and the region still so undeveloped that I think this is going to be a crisis that will continue for several months to come.
And I guess the final question would be, when my listeners here in the U.S. in a relatively peaceful situation, they hear about these massive disasters in distant countries and can feel pretty powerless. And I guess I'd like to ask you as a final question, what would you want listeners who are hearing this recording of you and Roberto, what would you want the listeners to do?
Well, I guess the message is always one of hope. UNICEF is always hopeful. Our whole premise is based on the idea that children are the next generation and deserve to have all of their rights fulfilled. The second message would be that people shouldn't feel hopeless even though they're outside the situation. There are many actions that they can take, even on a very modest level. One is to contribute financially to the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, for example, which is the organization in the U.S. that does advocacy and raises funds for UNICEF, including the Darfur emergency. But there are always other actions that can be taken, and I tend to think that everything is connected to everything else, and if people volunteer for soup kitchens, that also, in a way, is going to touch on creating a better world. So I guess that sounds kind of philosophic in a way, but from making a donation of $15 or $20 or whatever amount to UNICEF or the U.S. Fund for UNICEF to acting locally, people shouldn't feel like there's nothing that they can do. There's always something that can be done. Even talking about it in the classrooms, doing as you're doing, providing information to audiences about the situation so that maybe collections can be made. I would say that there is always something that some action that can be taken.
Well, Paula Claycombe, I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Public Health Radio.
Well, thank you. Thanks for your interest, and please give us a ring back if you need any further information.
And thank Roberto as well.
I will do that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
For those who would like to learn more about the political and human rights aspects of the conflict in Western Sudan, listeners can access the website of Human Rights Watch at hrw.org and also the International Committee of the Red Cross at icrc.org. And for listeners who wish to learn more about the work of UNICEF, both in Sudan and elsewhere, and who may wish to contribute to UNICEF, their website is unicefusa.org. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.